Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage's completely online process lets you get a custom mortgage solution wherever and whenever you want. Check out Rocket Mortgage at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, Trump and immigration, a SpaceX explosion, Clinton's war chest, Colin Kaepernick. Donald Trump flew to Mexico, came home, still talking the wall. On day one of a Trump presidency, he said,
"We will begin working on an impenetrable, physical, tall, powerful, beautiful southern border wall."
NFL QB Colin Kaepernick did not stand again for the national anthem. Last night, he took a knee.
Everybody watching Kaepernick during the national anthem, he kneels for it along with teammate Eric Reed.
And a SpaceX rocket explodes on its Cape Canaveral launch pad. Lots of plans up in a fireball. Here's ABC's David Curley.
This SpaceX rocket erupting on the pad like a bomb going off. And it wasn't just one explosion, several followed. The force of the blast felt by residents miles away from Cape Canaveral.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Jenna Johnson of The Washington Post, Margaret Tolliv of Bloomberg News, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What did you hear from Trump this week in Mexico, in Phoenix? What do you make of the polls tightening in the race between Trump and Clinton? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is Jenna Johnson, political reporter covering Donald Trump at The Washington Post. Jenna, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. Also from Washington, Margaret Tolliv is with us. She covers the White House and the 2016 election for Bloomberg News. Margaret, welcome. Great to have you back.
Hi, Tom. Great to be here.
Great to have you. And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Jenna, and Margaret.
All right. I want to look at immigration, but let's just first get the framework of these polls. I don't know how much they matter. Here we are still, what, a couple of months now from the vote. But what has happened, Margaret Tolliv? When people talk about the polls narrowing, how much?
There has been a real tightening of the polls. But if you look at all of the battleground states and all of the trajectory for the last several weeks, it is still a situation in which Hillary Clinton has enough of a distinct advantage that her campaign is still looking and talking about states like Arizona and Utah and Georgia. And Trump and the Republican Party are still facing major staffing issues in states like Florida where they're going to need turnout operations. It's hard to tell what the polls really mean now. Labor Day is the traditional turning point where people come home from vacation and begin paying attention to these things. Hillary Clinton should not feel great about anything, but Donald Trump really shouldn't feel great either about it. And he is talking, you know, every chance he gets about, look at the polls, look at the polls. The polls are really still not good for him. They're just less good for her.
Jenna Johnson, how does that fact of the polling, and Donald Trump we know follows the polling, how does it factor into his decision this week to, I guess, jump in a big chopper and head down to Mexico City?
It factors in very largely. Yesterday, his top aides gathered in Trump Tower and celebrated. They thought that Wednesday was one of the best days that they've had on the campaign trail, and they think it could lead to them winning this election. And what happened on Wednesday was, yeah, he took this very last-minute trip down to Mexico City, kind of surprising the Mexican government that he so quickly took them up on an offer to come visit. He met with the president for about an hour, and then he gave some public remarks, standing on a stage with a world leader, and saying nice things about a country that he has insulted so many times in so many ways on the campaign trail, and seemed to strike a very different tone, a tone that a lot of pundits called presidential. He then flew back to the United States, got to Phoenix, And we saw the old Donald Trump return. He gave a speech that he often shouted and really doubled down on a lot of hardline stances on immigration that he took during the primaries and were very popular during the primaries. There was an indication that he might soften on some of these positions now that he's headed into a general election. But in that speech in Phoenix, it became very clear that he's not walking away from the ideas that he's put out there on immigration, building a wall, deporting millions of people very quickly from the country, and having an attitude of Americans first above all else.
Donald Trump right here, back from Mexico in Phoenix, as you say, shouting that speech in large part on Wednesday.
There will be no amnesty. Our message to the world will be this. You cannot obtain legal status or become a citizen of the United States by illegally entering our country. Can't do it.
Can't do it. And how hard will it be to get in? Well, you have to go through some vetting, extreme vetting. He said at one point, extreme vetting.
I call it extreme vetting, right? Extreme vetting. I want extreme. It's going to be so tough. And if somebody comes in, that's fine, but they're going to be good. It's extreme.
Margaret Tolle, we heard reports of Hispanic supporters of Donald Trump bailing or pulling back after this Phoenix speech. On the other hand, as Jenna Johnson reports, his core team was celebrating, saying they thought they pushed his candidacy forward, maybe even to victory in this Wednesday trip. It's a long time till Election Day, but what do you see?
It's a real whiplash to try to follow, in many ways, the developments of this from day to day or week by week. But the Trump campaign and had put together like this Hispanic Advisory Council. Many of these folks are, you know, fairly new to engagement with the campaign. And part of this was to try to hear from them about what would be alternatives to, you know, mass deportation and that sort of thing. And with with the developments of the last several days, there are now people talking privately and publicly about, you know, how long they can continue to stand by him. So I think it is he has had this real balancing act between holding together the core of his base and reaching beyond that core, maybe not even across party lines, maybe kind of into independent territory or into groups that are traditionally may lean Republican on social issues, but have been averse because of some of their earlier statements about Mexican Americans or immigration. And he is continuing to struggle with how to appeal more broadly to Hispanics, how to appease sort of white centrist but right-leaning voters who have not been entirely comfortable. And it's not entirely clear to me how he expands his reach after the Mexico visit and the speech that has followed.
But as we see those polls tightening, I mean, and we've got a lot of pushback in Mexico now to the Mexican president there having offered this invitation or accepted Donald Trump's visit. Mexicans saying, what have you done here? Hillary Clinton saying this is not the way to do international affairs. And, well, that's her view, but we'll see how what voters think of it. Here she was at the American Legion on Wednesday saying that Trump could not erase all the insults he'd tossed at Mexico by having one meeting with the Mexican president.
It certainly takes more than trying to make up for a year of insults and insinuations by dropping in on our neighbors for a few hours and then flying home again. That is not how it works.
That's not how it works. Jack Beatty, you've got plenty of kind of establishment figures echoing that sentiment, and not just in Hillary Clinton's camp. You've got the editorial page of the Wall Street Journal today talking about Trump's Fortress America, saying that if he loses, his vision of an America that fears more than welcomes immigrants will be a large part of the reason. Of course, the Chamber of Commerce people have always been more in favor of immigration. I'm reading here today in The Hill, they're reporting that Henry Kissinger and George Shultz, huge security advisors to many Republican presidents, Nixon, Ford, and more, are thinking of coming out. They told Politico that they may come out and back Hillary Clinton. And yet the polls tighten in the week that Donald Trump does his immigration deportation nation speech, Jack.
They do tighten, and the polls have bad news for Hillary Clinton, not just in the aggregate, but in the detail. at 58% unpopularity now, just 2 points below Mr. Trump, who's the all-time leader in that category. But I do think that the speech confirmed Hillary Clinton's speech of last week, where she said that Trump's campaign was now essentially a vector of the alt-right. It was an alt-right speech, and you can tell that by the response. 15 out of 30 of the Hispanic advisors thinking of quitting on the as a result of it. Meanwhile, David Duke, he's tweeting, he thought the speech was terrific, and there are people in the further reaches of the right who have also tweeted. And public opinion, in a Fox poll this week, 77% of Americans want some kind of legalization for residents, just the opposite of the Trump picture.
So where does that leave us at the end of this week, Jenna Johnson?
Well, what Trump's campaign is hoping is that above all of the issues, above all else, that voters will want a candidate who sticks by his guns, who takes a position and stays with it, even if it's an unpopular decision. So it remains to be seen if that's true or not.
Elizabeth in Albuquerque, New Mexico is calling. Elizabeth, thanks for calling. You're on the air. What do you see?
Hi, Tom. My comment is regarding the wall that Trump wants to build. I think it sends the wrong message to Mexico, who is an ally country of ours, and that would leave it open for any other country, you know, to become an ally to Mexico, like Russia. You know, do we really want Russia in our back door like that? I don't think that's beneficial to the United States.
You think it would be such a jarring event for Mexico if you had a Trump presidency that they would turn to Russia as a backer?
Well, I mean, Russia would probably, you know, count on that. The United States helps Mexico a lot financially and in other ways. We like to keep them on our side. That wall would send the wrong message. I mean, we don't do that to allied countries. Mexico would, you know, probably benefit from it.
Yeah, who knows where that goes? I mean, Jack Beatty, you've got a guy who will shake the checkerboard here, and he shakes it again this week. And you say that means alt-right, but the polls say he's closer to Hillary Clinton than when the week began.
Yes, and partly because in 2 weeks he hasn't done things like, arguing with a gold star mother. This has been a remarkably sober 2 weeks for Mr. Trump.
Well, call it sober or call it shouting and alienating to Hispanic voters. We'll see how that turns out. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're looking at a week in the news, Trump and immigration, the SpaceX explosion, Hillary Clinton and her fundraising prowess in August, Chicago murders, Colin Kaepernick, what big protests in Venezuela and impeachment in Brazil, trouble for Apple on taxes in Ireland, the EU saying not that way. You can join us this hour. Do you know what Donald Trump is saying now on immigration beyond build the wall? What do we know after his trip to Mexico, his speech in Phoenix? Does Hillary have the right strategy to be raising money and announcing policy rather than making grand gestures? And why do you think this race is tightening? I guess also, if it's the year of the outsider, what do you make of primary victories this week for John McCain, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, Marco Rubio? Margaret Tolliver is with us, covers the White House and the election for Bloomberg News. Jenna Johnson is here, reporter for The Washington Post, follows the Trump campaign. Jack Beatty is here as well. I want to ask about these down-ballot and not very far down-ballot primary races this week. We had victories for John McCain, Republican in Arizona, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, Marco Rubio. All have had their troubles in this election season. Here was John McCain. He talked after winning a tightly contested primary race on Tuesday, said Republicans need to focus on maintaining power so that they can serve as an effective check on the executive.
We must be able to resist from a position of strength ideas coming from the next White House, whoever occupies it, that would take the country in the wrong track. It's imperative Republicans maintain our majorities in Congress.
Margaret Tolliver, what a speech. John McCain saying we have to be ready to resist, you know, the ideas from whoever is in the White House next. It sounds as though he's saying whether it's Hillary Clinton or it's Donald Trump, he's hunkering down.
Yeah, that's exactly what he's saying. And I mean, I would look for I would look for any Republican who made it out of a tight kind of Trumpish challenge to tack much more to the middle in terms of distancing themselves from him and trying to appeal to the center heading into a general election. But also they do so with, you know, no, it's like they're not leaving anything on the table. It's not like they want to be more closely aligned with Donald Trump. You know, I think if you look at I see kind of two bookends to the summer and reading tea leaves for Trump versus Clinton. If you look at what happened with Rubio, John McCain, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, those all suggest that Trump's impact, you know, is containable. If you look at what's happening in Britain with Brexit, if you look at what's happened in Brazil and now Venezuela, you see something different, which is this kind of global sense of throw out the bums, concern about either corruption, economic collapse, all of the above, dissatisfaction, you know, we're mad as hell, we're not going to take it anymore. When you see that, kind of popping all over the world, and you're the Trump campaign, you think that's very good. That's what we're kind of latching on to. Of course, the U.S. isn't the same as other countries. The electoral system is different than a popular vote. And so none of these are exact parallels. But what happened in those primaries paints a really different picture than the kind of global wave that that Trump has been hoping to take advantage of earlier this year.
We had another riffle this week that got people cocking eyebrows over what may be coming in November or before. News of hackers getting into voter registration lists in the United States, warnings that that those could be possibly disrupted from abroad. Here was FBI Director James Comey talking at a cybersecurity conference on Tuesday. Said the FBI is working hard to understand whether a foreign government is hacking U.S. systems in order to influence our elections.
We take very seriously any effort by any actor, including nation states, maybe especially nation states, that moves beyond the collection of information about our country and that offers the prospect of an effort to influence the conduct of affairs in our country, whether that's an election or something else.
FBI director putting that in rather high-blown terms, but down on the ground where this hit, here's Tom Holbrook, his county clerk in St. Clair, Illinois. One of two states whose election systems were targeted by hackers. States now saying the information about 90,000 voters was breached. He talked with local station KPLR about the incident.
I think it's an absolute travesty. I think this is literally a cyber war on the United States.
I mean, Jenna Johnson, in a season where there's already talk about questioning election results, Donald Trump certainly has said if he doesn't win, then there's something rigged going on here. Adding any kind of hacking into the mix is pretty unsettling. Are these defensible systems, Jenna?
Well, that's really the question. And states are racing to secure their systems so that the elections will not be compromised in any way. But this isn't the first time that Russia has been accused of getting involved and meddling in the election this year. Let's not forget that the hack of DNC email has been blamed on Russia. And there's a lot of unease about these outside attacks, about this possible outside influence on the system. You know, a lot of people worried that the results might not be accurate. And you can believe that if Donald Trump does not win the election in November, he will definitely be reminding people of these sorts of things, raising questions about if the results are trustworthy or not.
Talk about politics being dragged out onto a very funky field here. That's the last thing we need. We had Hillary Clinton at the American Legion this week. I mean, she was out with a big policy statement on mental health, Jack. Also talking with the American Legion about American leadership in the world. Also, we learned that she raised, I think, a record amount in August. I want to talk to you about what she's been up to. But listen to her for a second here, talking with the American Legion about a, what, sort of traditional, at least post-war traditional, World War II traditional American stance of leadership in the world. Here was Clinton.
When America fails to lead, we leave a vacuum that either causes chaos or other countries or networks rush in to fill the void. So no matter how hard it gets, no matter how great the challenge, America must lead.
America must lead. Jack, we kind of see where Trump is tacking this week. Where's Hillary tacking?
Well, in that passage, at least some of her liberal critics feel that she tacked toward the right. This language, when America fails to lead, we leave a vacuum and other countries or forces rush in to fill it. That's the very criticism that hawks have been making of President Obama's handling of Iraq and Syria, that we left a vacuum in Iraq, and ISIS came in and filled it, and that shows that if we didn't stay on the ground there with who knows how many troops, this is what can happen. And Libya is another example. And of course, the assumption behind that is American omnipotence. If we're there, bad things won't happen. And the assumption further is that the vacuum created, well, really all that began when we invaded the place, which was a decision the president, as a state senator, decried and was right to. So that, in a recent poll, the erosion of Hillary's support since the convention bounce was among different groups. One group was liberals. And the reason partly is statements like that, I think, that give people a little neuralgia about, wait a minute, why is she validating this, in many people's views, spurious criticism of President Obama's foreign policy and implicitly hawkish line?
Jack, what about the lower profile? I guess, compared to Donald Trump, who's, off in his own chopper whirling around Mexico City. But on the other hand, Clinton's not made so many appearances. She's put policy out. She's made a big speech at the American Legion. She's here and there. But is she playing rope-a-dope with Trump here? And is that a good strategy at this point, Jack?
Well, people are, there's been some criticism of that. And the Financial Times the other day ran a piece about what she's been doing over the month. And it's, hitting Martha's Vineyard hard, hitting Nantucket
money,
hard.
Money,
money, money, money. Hollywood, Hollywood, Beverly Hills. And people, well, yes, and she's got $150 million out of it. But has that been the best way to spend her time while Trump, in his dramatic gesture in Mexico, seems to have he monopolized a news cycle pretty much 2 days straight. Now, Mrs. Clinton did make an important announcement. You referenced it about mental health. The Washington Post says it's one of the most important statements about public policy and mental health in years. She calls for $5 billion community health centers to money for community health centers to provide substance abuse and mental health treatment, to integrate physical the care of the body and the care of the mind, and the Post credits her with some vision there, but all that gets stepped on by Trump's bold gesture and by Mrs. Clinton's sort of disappearance for days at a time while she shuttles around Martha's Vineyard.
Let's go to Fred in Middletown, Connecticut. Fred, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Listen, I'd like you to cycle back to Trump and his meeting in Mexico. Nobody has talked about the fact that the president of Mexico gave a detailed refutation of Trump's serial lies about immigration, about the economic impacts. Number two, nobody's commented on the fact that Trump, at the Arizona speech, actually called for the repeal of the 1965 Naturalization Immigration Act. And David Duke of the Ku Klux Klan has heralded it because he's then said we can then, cancel the citizenships that have been awarded to people since 1965 who were immigrants. I mean, it's just stunning. And why isn't anybody talking about that?
Well, there's been a lot of talk about the apparent divergence in description of what went on there, where the Mexican president said, yes, we talked about the wall and that Mexico would not pay for it. At least he did. Trump said no discussion of that. Jenna Johnson, I hate to make Donald Trump responsible for what David Duke says. On the other hand, he certainly is talking about going back to a kind of immigration policy that we have not seen in this country in many decades, and immigration policy that produced a much less diverse flow of immigrants.
That's just it. And that's why Donald Trump's speech was very popular with a lot of people who not only define themselves as being white supremacists, but also people who consider themselves to be part of the alt-right movement. The Trump campaign has said that they disavow people who are white supremacists, that he does not want their votes, he said in one interview. But that doesn't mean that those people stop following him and trumpeting him and really liking him. And the Clinton campaign has come out and said, you know, the stances that Donald Trump has taken are dangerous and play to this crowd, and that he's not doing enough to discourage them. The Clinton campaign even came out with a video, unlike any I had ever seen in presidential politics, showing members of the KKK or former members of the KKK saying what they like about Donald Trump. And a lot of times, one of the biggest things they talk about is his stances on immigration.
He's headed for a black church in Philadelphia today, also to talk with more African Americans in Detroit. There's been some early reporting about the kind of messages that he wants to take to that community, which has been anything but supportive. What do we know there, Jenna?
Well, he has, for the past 2 weeks, been making a very aggressive appeal to minority voters, basically painting them with a very broad brush and saying, your lives are terrible. You're underemployed or unemployed. You live in dangerous neighborhoods. You can't walk down the street without getting shot. Stop trusting Democrats and vote for me. And the line that he uses over and over again is, what do you have to lose? And he's faced a lot of criticism for delivering this message at rallies with all white audiences. And so this week, the campaign is finally making the effort to try to put him in front of black audiences. But this is going to be in very small, you know, groups. He's going to be doing a roundtable discussion this afternoon in Philadelphia, tomorrow in Detroit. He's going to visit an African-American church and do an interview. But it's very closely scripted. You know, I mean, they're being very careful to not put him in a position where he can unexpectedly be attacked or anything like that. There's been talk of maybe him doing a walking tour of Detroit with Ben Carson, but that hasn't been confirmed yet.
On Thursday, NBA star Dwayne Wade talked with ABC's George Stephanopoulos about the death of his cousin, Nikia Aldridge. She was caught in the crossfire of a shooting, pushing her baby in a stroller in Chicago. And Stephanopoulos asked Wade, you may have heard this, about Donald Trump, who had said in a tweet that the shooting was just one more reason for African Americans to vote for him. Dwayne Wade said he was conflicted about Trump's tweet.
On one end, your cousin's death is used as a ploy for a political gain. On the other end, it's a national story. It goes back to that for me. I want eyes on this city. You know, I want us to be able to do more together. And the only way we can do more together is more people know what's going on.
Jack Beatty, I mean, here's Trump getting right into Dwayne Wade's family business. But in a week when we have news of a record number of gun deaths in Chicago, wondering, should we bring out the National Guard, talking about doubling the number of police there? I mean, like, there's clearly a problem here. Trump's trying to take that and say, look, I'm the answer.
90 murders in the month of August, the most violent since the mid-90s when there was a crack cocaine epidemic and gang warfare were rife. And Jesse Jackson calling for the president to, he says, you visit Sandy Hook. You visit Orlando, come here and talk about the causes of violence. But Trump's initial tweet was so embarrassing, essentially patting himself on the back for his foresight in predicting violence and, you know, in saying American cities are violent, was so offensive that his people on the air on Sunday, even the ever glib Kellyanne Conway, could not even begin to defend it. They just went to the next page because it was so, the word narcissistic is just inevitable, trading on this murder.
You know, but the numbers are there, Margaret.
Well, they are. But there is a difference between taking what's happening in Chicago and and sort of extrapolating that nationally to say that this is the experience that all African Americans are having all over the country.
Yep.
And, you know, I think I see this as all connected. And when we were talking a few minutes ago about sort of Clinton's pace and tack over the summer, why she isn't out there as much, why she's fundraising, it's because why get in the way of what Donald Trump is doing? And that's been her philosophy. Every time her poll numbers go down, it's because of her, not because he's great. She sees staying out of the way as a way to maximize her advantage and her buffer.
Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage brings home financing into the 21st century with a completely online process that's fast, easy, and convenient. Using a phone or tablet, you can safely share bank statements and pay stubs without having to dig through piles of paperwork. It takes just a few minutes to get a custom mortgage solution on your terms, wherever and whenever you want. Check out Rocket Mortgage at quickenloans.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSConsumerAccess.org number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week in Venezuela, hundreds of thousands turned out to protest against President Nicolas Maduro's government, which they blame for the country's worsening food crisis. Here's a man who waited in line for food for hours in Caracas. He spoke with the PBS NewsHour.
I have a job, but what's the point? My salary is worth nothing. Right now, you can't even get rice or corn flour. For everything, you have to wait in line.
Maine Governor Paul LePage unleashed a stream of obscenities on a Democratic Maine state rep last Friday, touched off a string of contradictory statements about whether LePage would resign from office.
I've spent my life helping black people, and you little son of a socialist, I need you to, this freaking, I want you to record this and make it public because I am after you.
Record this and make it public? Well, now it is. And Gene Wilder, star of Willy Wonka and Young Frankenstein and more, died from Alzheimer's complications at the age of 83. Here he was in Young Frankenstein.
If you're blue and you don't know where to go to, why don't you go where fashion sits?
Rest in peace, Gene Wilder. We're looking at a week in the news. Trump and immigration, the SpaceX explosion, Chicago murders, Colin Kaepernick, and more. Brazil, impeachment, Venezuela, lots of protests there. You can join us this hour. Are you watching Caracas, Brazil, watching the upheaval in Huma Abedin's marriage to Anthony Weiner? Oh, boy. Did you see Colin Kaepernick kneel last night for the national anthem? Where does that go? With Jenna Johnson of The Washington Post, she follows the Trump campaign, political reporter there. Margaret Tollef joins us from Bloomberg News. She covers the White House and the 2016 election. Jack Beatty's here. Let's go to Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Chris is calling. Hi, Chris. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I want to talk about Venezuela. I didn't realize that there were starving people in our own hemisphere. I can't believe they've been starving, and I just saw it on the news a couple of days ago. Where are the food ships? Where's all the news reporting about? I'm just in shock.
Chris, I appreciate your call. Margaret Tollef, the president's headed to Asia right now. The camera, the eye of the U.S. media is going to turn there. But as you say, upheaval in Brazil and certainly in Venezuela as well. It's food shortage, but with a deep, deep political root, Margaret.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, Central America and South America, the hemisphere has been a region that both President Obama and Vice President Biden have been trying to engage a little bit more in over the last few years. But given the upheaval in the rest of the world, it's been really difficult. This is an area they've had their eye on for quite a while. And I do expect in China and in Laos that the president is going to get questions on this and is going to have a little bit of time to think through what's the message that he wants to send.
Is there any kind of American policy on what's going on in Caracas? Is it just hands off? Is there some kind of, you know, standing call for something or just watching?
Yeah, I mean, the administration has kind of tried to toggle back and forth already with Maduro in terms of, you know, expressing the need for the people to be heard when you have any kind of a representative government. This is now, at this point, it's September now. This is going to certainly be a problem that the next president inherits. And I think it's also something that both Clinton and Trump should be asked about, if we could ever ask her any questions and if he would ever give kind of a long, complex answer. This is a problem that will certainly last beyond President Obama's time in office.
Chris, in Milwaukee, we are watching and have been watching, but that's a very complicated picture. Of course, right now it's boiling down to real hunger in Brazil. You had President Dilma Rousseff talking here after she was formally removed from power on Wednesday. Impeachment proceedings. She remained defiant, interpreted here by Reuters.
They have just overthrown the first woman elected president of Brazil without there being any constitutional justification for this impeachment. But the coup was not just carried out against me and my party. This was just the beginning. The coup is going to strike, without distinction, every progressive and democratic political organization.
Watch this space as all that comes undone in Brazil. Edward in Montreal in Canada. Edward, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Yeah, I took note of the SpaceX explosion yesterday. It was a very sad event, but I also took note of the fact that it was a dress rehearsal. So SpaceX, they, unlike other launch companies, they do a dress rehearsal with all the pieces in place before every launch, and
yep.
Much preferable that this event occur at a dress rehearsal rather than the actual live event. Nobody was injured or harmed in any way other than the equipment.
Well,
and SpaceX is being very bold. They're boldly going into space. They have a very visionary schedule, unlike NASA, which is cautious and timid, two steps forward, three steps back. And I think we need to accept these little setbacks if we're going to advance the mission of humanity, which is to extend ourselves into the solar system.
I mean, maybe you're right, Edward, but there's a lot of taking lemons and making lemonade right there. I mean, it may have been a dress rehearsal, but the $200 million rocket that was supposed to go up was lost. We heard from Mark Zuckerberg at Facebook, who had on that, a satellite that was supposed to bring internet connections into underserved parts of Africa, feeling pretty disappointed about it. Jack, we're looking here at space exploration in the hands of Elon Musk, who is definitely bold, but it's not the first time we've seen one of these rockets go up. This is hard stuff, and that's an expensive failure.
It is, and experts say it's the first accident of its kind since 1959. Which underlines just how rare this is, and the Times today is full of a long story, basically tying this event in with other hiccups, you might say, in Mr. Musk's futurist project, including the Tesla car that the person on autopilot that resulted in a fatality, and the question raised is he is he pushing things too fast and too far? He says, you know, we were careless. Well, is the carelessness because the pace of his ambition is too strong? We don't know.
Boldly going where no one has gone before. Of course, people have gone, but on a new basis here. Omaha, Nebraska. Jim, thanks for calling. You're on.
Hi, Tom. I think the SpaceX explosion just reaffirms the fact of how difficult it really is to get into space. And I think that the chances of SpaceX or any other private company getting manned into space becomes more and more remote, and we'll have to rely on Russia to do that. Thanks.
I appreciate your call. Margaret, are you following that? I mean, the plan is, I believe, for SpaceX to go beyond supply missions and putting satellites up and ultimately get into manned space flight and launches. What about U.S. dependence on private versus, you know, private American companies in this case versus Russia or anybody else?
Yeah, I do. I think the short-term story is a business story. It's about Elon Musk, exactly as Jack said. Is he flying too close to the sun? What's going to happen if he goes out to seek, you know, more money, and are people going to want to back him? That's the story that's right in front of us. But the much broader story is what has government gotten out of the business of, or should be getting out of the business of, how do you get there without it? And on a kind of a political level, I think when you look at the Clinton Global Foundation, when you look at the role that President Obama is going to want to move more into after he leaves office, you see the idea of that kind of bridge between politics and investors and kind of global leaders. This is something beyond that. This is looking at the private sector to harness technology in a way that government can't, because government is constrained by more rules, because government is like a ship that turns around slower. And the downsides of experimentation like this is that if you're unfettered by those rules and you move too fast, you can get ahead of yourself. Bad things can happen. The upside is, I mean, can you imagine what the trajectory of the government version of SpaceX would be right now, considering the relations between Democrats and Republicans in Congress?
I guess going right. Nowhere fast, though. When NASA was pushing the envelope, it had its own tragedies and explosions on the launch pad. Well remembered. I want to turn to another high-tech business story, this one out of the EU and Ireland around Apple. Yeah. The EU saying, look, you've got Apple, you need to pay $14+ billion in taxes that Ireland gave you this big break on. Here's the EU commissioner. This is Margaret Vestager, commissioner for competition. On Tuesday, she ordered Apple to pay that almost $15 billion in unpaid taxes, she said. And she talked with CNN about how low Ireland had cut Apple's taxes, why she made this move.
Illegal state aid has been given out to Apple. And that is, of course, unfair to all the businesses who pay their taxes, who compete on the merits, the quality of their products, the service that they can give to their customers, when they see that other companies pay maybe only a fraction. And in this case, taxation as low as 0.005%.
0.005%. That's pretty low taxation. Apple CEO Tim Cook talked with Irish Radio, RTE News, said the European Commission's ruling that they should pay those billions in back taxes. He said, politically motivated, he said.
It's maddening. It's maddening. It's disappointing. It's clear that this comes from a political place. It has no basis in fact or in law. Unfortunately, it's one of those things we have to work through.
Just political. Well, of course, money on that scale is political, but that's a pretty low tax rate they've been paying there. Here's John online with us, says, I can't believe the U.S. Treasury is whining about Europe demanding that Apple pay taxes, even though the taxes they are avoiding should go to us, i.e. the United States. He writes, our government's incapable of going after them, so making Ireland tax them would remove the incentive that allows American companies to legally cheat on their taxes. This is some kind of spectacle. Jenna, I don't know if you're following this at all, but there's been a lot of concern about these big corporate moves for years now. Donald Trump talking about them, Hillary Clinton sometimes as well, that have let companies take such big whacks of their tax burden right off the books. And now the EU calling Apple and Ireland out on this. It's something to see.
Yes, exactly. I mean, for decades. I mean, the American way is to try to pay as little in taxes as possible. And U.S. corporations have gotten very crafty with it. I think most
on a grand
Americans,
scale, we see right here.
Exactly, exactly. And I think a lot of Americans look at stories like this and look at how much they're paying in their own taxes. And it's really frustrating, especially when they hear that, budgets are tight at their local schools or things like that. Donald Trump talks a lot about Apple is one of the companies that he goes after, not so much on their taxes, but for making a lot of their products overseas. We should also note that Donald Trump is a businessman himself who has said that he tries to pay as little in taxes as he can. And he's the first major presidential nominee in decades to not release his tax returns and show Americans what his tax rate is, and if he is, perhaps paying a very low amount, if anything.
That seems to me should be a bigger issue than it is in this campaign, when being a successful businessman is number one kind of resume qualification for the job. Well, everybody else shows their tax returns. What about Donald Trump? We're going to follow that. Mac in St. Charles Parish, Louisiana. Mac, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
I was wanting to comment on calling Kaepernick Neal and refusing to stand for the national anthem.
Yes.
And he's getting a lot of flack about that. But I think it's for a great cause. But then again, I guess it's because I'm an African-American, too. And you're getting a lot of flack about that. But it's not the first time that a football player has taken a knee or sitting down through the national anthem. And I just don't understand why. Well, a lot of people say there's no cause for this, but if you look at it, you look around the country and you see African-Americans are falling to death, and not only by other African-Americans or other individuals of America, by the police force, by the people who's supposed to protect us, they're killing us for no good reason. And if you live out here, well, I'm from Metairie, Louisiana.
Yeah.
You get a lot of flack from the police, which I understand that there's a lot of things going on in America, and the police do need to police different areas, but not police everybody that live in the area and then take the draw of your gun and kill, what, 14 innocent people? One man running away, one young boy, 12 years old. That it makes no sense. And they know what they're doing. And then you have people have the nerve enough to say, well, if you won't stand for the national anthem, you should leave our country. Well, I guess the Indians say the same thing about us.
Mac, I really appreciate your call. I mean, it's very interesting what happened here. Of course, he sat down last week during the national anthem. That got a lot of attention. And then ESPN reporting here that he had a big conversation with Nate Boyer on the 49ers, former Army Green Beret, and now he's a long snapper for the 49ers, and safety Eric Reed. They got together in a hotel room on Thursday afternoon, had this game in San Diego coming up, shifted gears, decided it would be more respectful to kneel rather than just sit down. And I mean, Kaepernick, he's thinking this through. They're quoting him saying, we were talking to him about how we can get the message back on track, not take away from the military, not take away from pride in our country, keep the focus on issues that really, what the issues really are. Kaepernick saying, I'm not anti-American. I love America. I love people. That's why I'm doing this. I want to help make America better. Margaret, how do you see this thing playing out? It is interesting how keenly it's raised it up again, where protest is appropriate and what kind of protest is appropriate in the hand or knee here of a NFL quarterback.
Yeah, Colin Kaepernick is such an interesting, cultural figure. He's 28 years old. He's biracial, adopted, feels very strongly about what he's seeing going on with violence against African Americans in this country and with kind of the way the nation has digested the news of the last few months. And he's trying to do a social protest. If you want to talk about this at a very cynical level, it's like, how do you protest and keep your money, right? But I think there's something less cynical going on, which is, how do you have the most effective message? You're obviously more effective making a message from the inside than from the outside. This kneeling is an attempt to find a way to be respectful while still making the point. And I think the team seems to be rallying behind him in trying to help him to do that. It's very interesting to watch.
Knelt during the anthem, but then clapped, applauded veterans and military during the halftime break, and stood for God Bless America. Jack, this young quarterback is walking a dice, careful line here.
Solomonic. I mean, he's divided the baby, and he seems to have done a pretty good job with it. And freedom of expression is part of what you commemorate with the Star Spangled Banner.
Taking a knee to the national anthem. Not sure what people are going to do with that. Interesting week. Jenna Johnson with the Washington Post. Thanks so much for being with us, Jenna.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
Margaret Tolivar, thanks to you.
Thank you, Tom.
And Jack Beatty, you too. Thanks to all. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.